Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
You know, when you write a book like this, there's a whole set of mixed objectives and hopes. One hopes that it will have an impact in some meaningful way that kind of improves the situation in terms of work and debt, given that it seems to be so bad at the moment. But in realistic terms, I just want my main hope, I think, rather than kind of, you know, I get asked all of the time, you know, so what's the alternative? You know, where's your blue? As if I've got this kind of large rolled up sheet that I can kind of let roll to the ground and, you know, well, this is where we put the hospitals and this is where we put this, you know, I'm not qualified to come up with a blueprint for a new society. But I would like to hope that a book like this starts a conversation. Put certain issues and questions back on the table that we might want to discuss, rather than pretending that none of these things exist. So simply getting this set of problems that I think so many of us are facing onto the table for discussion, so that we now can begin to put it into the public domain, would be the main hope of this book.
Capitalism creates a good deal of socioeconomic crap as rules. Pollution, stress, insecurity, in-work poverty, waste, the inevitable collateral damage of profit-seeking behaviour. When the business system offloads this crap, it gets passed down to a vast chain until it can't be passed any further. Nobody wants to be at the end of this shit chain, usually reserved for the global poor, women, the natural environment and so forth. The compelling words of Peter Fleming, the Professor of Business and Society at City University of London. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to examine the nature of neo-capitalism and ask, what has it done for the average worker? Tonight, I'm joined by economist, teacher and author, Dr. Peter Fleming, whose latest book, The Debt of Homo Economicus, Work, Death and the Myth of Endless Accumulation, has just been published by Pluto Press, where Peter argues, employment is today one of the leading causes of distress for a simple reason. It has become connected to everything else in life, and one's fortunes are entirely dependent upon it. For those of us who are not part of the global elite or transnational criminal class, paid work is the only way to obtain money. And of course, everything is linked to the curse of cash. So what is commando capitalism? And has loneliness and marginalisation become an epidemic in neoliberal societies?
So I'm Professor Peter Fleming. I'm a professor at Cass Business School. I've just written a book called The Death of Homo Economicus. It's a book on the topic of work, debt, and the economy that's been in a long, long recession. The objective of the book was to provide a human side to all of the economic statistics that we see on a regular basis in the media, to get underneath those statistics and look at the human lives being affected. And so kind of a bleak book, because it's not exactly a pretty story what's going on, and particularly around the topic of work, which has become quite regressive in terms of social justice issues and politics and so forth. And I also examine debt and the austerity measures that successive governments have been enacting in order to try and rectify what I call an economy that is kind of circling the drain. You know, it feels like it's the end game, and that's an economic issue, but also a cultural issue, an existential one. So I remember when I first arrived in England 15 years ago from Australia, and before that New Zealand, and the sense in the UK was one of optimism and kind of this kind of go-getter kind of mentality. And comparing it to today, there's a real sense of forlornness within the within the culture. And so this book is kind of a human narrative on the dark side of the economy. Some might call it bleak. Basically, I'm just trying to tell a truth, I guess, the truth behind the numbers. And that's the objective of the book.
Really well done on the book, Peter. You describe it as bleak. I would describe it as a very necessary read, although you can't read this book anyway passively, because I know that most readers will feel a growing sense of rage and injustice as they progress through the book in terms of how we're all evolving. And I think, you know, when you develop an idea on the gig economy, you see just how vulnerable workers are. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off. And it's a pretty simple question in one way, but it raises a lot of psychological stakes, so to speak. Why do we work?
That's a very, very good question. You know, when we ask people why we work, the basic and, you know, in some ways very correct answer is to live. If I didn't work, I wouldn't receive an income and I wouldn't be able to pay my bills. I wouldn't be able to go to the supermarket and so forth. So there is a connection with biological self-preservation. But what I want to do in the book is kind of question that premise a little bit, because I've never really agreed with the idea, especially in this day and age in rich post-industrial countries, that there's a one-to-one relationship between me doing emails all day and my biological kind of organic survival. In some cases, according to medical experts, there's a negative relation. You know, it's actually hurting my body rather than securing its maintenance, which is quite interesting, you know. Sitting is the new smoking and so forth. So I think that there is not necessarily a direct relationship between me living and my organic survival and me doing emails. It's not like me doing emails to all day is akin to hunting and gathering, for example. So I've wanted to show how there's a strong cultural element to the institutions and the ceremonies around employment. Now, I'm not saying that it's all just made up, you know, and that I can just say to myself, look, I'm not going to work today because it's all a social construction, if you like. It's not, it's very real, and there'd be dire consequences if I did not go into the office. Having said that, I think it's become detached from that material basis, and that there is now kind of a ritualistic element, or what I call in the book a theatre of work, in which display is a very important part of the entire edifice of employment as it has developed over the last few years. And that really then kind of begs a number of questions, because if it isn't simply related to my biological necessity, my self-preservation, then why are we kind of putting in these extraordinary hours for those who have jobs? And why don't we kind of play with the idea of restructuring the role of employment in our lives that makes it a little bit more civilized? Now, that sounds all good on paper in theory, but it's funny when I talk to economists about this, you know, it's kind of like heresy. If I talk to politicians about this, and I have to a few politicians, you know, they literally run for the exit. They run the other way because, of course, that's all about votes, you know, it's all about jobs, jobs, jobs. Not so much about the quality of the jobs or the pay or the fulfillment or the creativity of the jobs, but just simply a job. And so it's really that kind of what I would call an economic bias that I'm trying to tackle in this book and to question why we work. You know, I've come to the conclusion that I think that we could shorten the working week, shorten the working day quite drastically and still have the same amount of output and economic prosperity.
Do you think it could be argued that work has become a permanent state of being? Like, you talk about it being kind of a ritual of sorts, but I'm just wondering, has it so entrenched ourselves in our psyche, in our understanding of life, that it is a state of being?
Oh, I think so. I think so. You know, and I think that's been an intentional political strategy over the years with the rise of neoliberalism, and in particular during its crash. I think we're living in a in a semi-post neoliberal capitalist world at the moment that's trying to cling on to that axiom. But, you know, one of the big kind of aims and objectives of neoclassical economics was to reconfigure the individual into a permanent enterprise. So in the past, especially after World War II, when there was a strong class kind of consciousness, you know, the working class, and even during in the middle class, you know, a job was considered something we had to do, but it was something that we did among other things. And so the objective of neoclassical economists, particularly in the Chicago School tradition, was to reconfigure that mentality to say, no, you are a permanent enterprise, a microcosm of a corporation, and you are individualized in that manner. And therefore, you know, everything about you can be related to economic gain or economic loss. So you have human capital theory, you've got all sorts of human resource theory that kind of reconfigures the individual into this permanent working machine. And that also has a little bit to do with the types of jobs we do because, you know, my grandfather was a coal miner in Scotland and a very, very difficult, long, dirty job. But it was something that you could walk away from because it was very external. You picked away at the coal face and then for 12 hours and then you walked away. But today our work is not necessarily as external. It's quite intimate with who we are as a person. You know, our ability to communicate with people and customers and clients, our ability to exude a certain personality. So the neoclassical tradition puts a lot of emphasis on my social capital, for example, my ability to talk to people. And the thing is that jobs are no longer something that we do among one thing we do among other things. It's kind of who we are. It's tied up to our identity with the help of mobile technology and so forth. And that means that the 9-to-5 is very kind of blurred. You know, my private and my work life is kind of melded and fused into one. And that means it's very difficult to turn off from. So when I go to a party, I have a young child now, so that's kind of rare. But when I used to go to a party, the first thing that people ask you is, what do you do? Because that's the most important thing. That defines everything about you. And all of the other stuff is secondary. And I think that's really interesting because we're seeing it peaked probably about 10 years ago, this kind of neoclassical idea of the continuous enterprise. And now we're starting to see the chickens come home to roost. We're seeing the very negative costs of what it means to turn someone into a permanent worker, where, you know, studies have shown people even work in their sleep and have their mobile phone, their emails beside them all night, just in case that important email comes through. Of course, it never does. And, you know, stress, burnout, family dysfunction, loneliness is an important one, alcohol abuse, sometimes drug abuse associated with this almost suicidal work culture. And that's really something I'm trying to kind of get to grips with and find a way out of in this book.
It's also limiting when you think about it in terms of how we are as people, in terms of how we connect, because if your day starts and ends with work and all your relationships are focused through work, it becomes a very condensed and tight space, doesn't it? In your introductions, Peter, you talk about how Western capitalism has developed and you compare it to a great backwash following a tsunami. And you talk about the widening corporate hellscape and the elite of dark money. You present a very, very frightening picture. Some people would accuse you of being slightly hysterical and sensationalist. So I'm just wondering what you say to that.
Well, I think we live in very extreme times. There are attempts on a daily basis to normalise it, you know, everything's okay. But if you look at the indicators, the inequality indicators, the productivity growth indicators, even the mainstream ones are all kind of redlining, if you like. And I was just looking for a metaphor to kind of find a way to capture what I think is happening at the economic, personal and cultural level. And when the financial crisis of 2007-2008 hit, everyone was talking about the tsunami, you know, because the imagery was very kind of forceful, and we'd seen, you know, all of the mobile phone technology allowed us to see what devastation it really meant. And everyone was talking about the tsunami as, you know, the wave hitting and destruction. Then we rebuild. And I thought, you know, I looked into the literature on tsunamis, and, you know, the really big waves do have this kind of the last phase, the most damaging phase, if you like, is the backwash, where all of that water has to return to the sea. And I thought that really captured kind of the economic era of austerity. It's not really a war on the people. It's kind of just draining the life out of everything. It's like a beautiful oil painting being kind of rendered black and white, and that the life is just being kind of slowly squeezed out of our being, out of our collective being, rather than anything drastic. And that's where the real cost kind of kicks in, I think, because it doesn't hit the headlines anymore. It's all very personalized and privatized. We live the crisis now as a very personal, private thing, and we don't have the dramatic headlines to kind of capture what we are all experiencing in this kind of long, long wake of the recession. So hysterical? Well, no, I'm not really an hysteric, I don't think. More trying to kind of find an alternative narrative to the mainstream economic view that kind of captures this existential damage that seems to have been incurred by a major group of the population who have no real vocabulary to describe it, and it doesn't hit the headlines of the papers anymore. And that kind of worked quite well in the book to set the scene for the cases that I then examine in more detail.
You argue employment has entered into an almost paradoxical phase, useless and symbolic on the one hand, universally necessary on the other, rendering it into a sort of theatre of cruelty. They're very strong words. So are you saying that, like, the modern worker is engaging in a form of self-sabotage? Is that it?
Yeah, I'm not too sure about that. I think it's kind of, I would use the word sacrifice, which has kind of interesting kind of religious connotations, because when you talk to people about the work ethic, you know, it does have all of these values associated with it that has an almost ecclesiastical tone, although it's often not stated as such. So I would see sacrifice as kind of the word that seems to be more in self-sacrifice, more apposite to what I'm talking about. So the argument there is basically this, that, you know, there are fewer jobs, so there are fewer people working more and more, so there is unemployment, and so we mustn't forget that this is not like an economy of full employment, which is important for the disciplinary role to get us to work so much for those who do have jobs, and that there is an overcapacity in much of the work we do. So two or three people could do my job, two or three people could do the banker's job who works 14 hours a day. And so, therefore, because it's impossible for me to go into the office at 8 and be bang on productive for 12 hours straight, it's impossible. There is a lot of kind of what some sociologists call empty labor involved, in which, you know, my productivity probably peaks at 10 o'clock in the morning, 11 maybe, and then there's a lot of time to fill in. And that time is filled in not by me just staring into space, but looking like a worker. And that display function is very, very important. The theatre of work is very, very important, to the point where there's one study in the US that reveals how management consultants, you know, they're expected to put in 80 hours a week, which is a grueling work week. They can't do it, and they can't actually be, this is the irony, they can't actually be productive and get their jobs done well if they did that, because they're tired all the time. And so they have to find ways to fake the 80-hour week. So setting up their timing their emails to send at a certain time of the middle of the night when they're actually sleeping, and various other ways of faking to actually look like they're putting in the grueling 80 hours a week. But on the other side, which is the kind of the paradox, if you like, there is an absolute, even though it's ritualistic and even though there's a strong ceremonial element, it is considered to be the absolute civic good in our society still, that we have a job and that we almost sacrifice ourselves to the altar of work before any other social need or relationship is entered into, to the point where, you know, even the unemployed are chastised and disciplined to look like a worker and to kind of get into the habit, if you like. And this is interesting because it hasn't always been like this. It's easy to see it and take it for granted as something that's normal. But if you look at that in the historical spectrum, we're living in very extreme times around the notion of work. And so one of the things I've tried to do in the book is to figure out why. Why exactly is this the case? If we look closely, and a lot of economists say this is the case as well, that we don't need to be working as much as we do. And if we look at the ritualistic empty labour that happens in a lot of jobs, I mentioned a study in the book where one guy didn't turn up to his work at all and to see if anyone would notice, and no one did because, you know, it was just one less employee on the office floor that was kind of, you know, negligible as a rule in terms of their concrete output. And so I want to figure out, why are we putting work on such a elevated pedestal and seeing it as the be all and end all of every part of our fibre, every part of our being, to the point where people will actually kind of work themselves to death in the name of it. And that's an interesting story that I try and tell.
Well, let me throw you a philosophical question. So, sure. Peter, do you think we've a manic attachment to money and making money? Because, you know, you present all these interesting statistics. I think it was a YouGov poll from earlier in the year, which showed that I think it was 37% of British workers feel that their job is both meaningless and lacks any form of purpose. And even another American study, which shows that I think up to 38% or something around that of American workers are not doing the job that they were recruited to do. So it seems also chaotic. But so at the back of it, we must have, as human beings, this driving force to perform, to make money, to, you know, to have status. Or we must just look at our lives as just work, 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 because it doesn't make sense from any other perspective.
Yeah. Well, I think that's all part of the cash culture of neoliberal capitalism. I tell a story in the book about when I was a child, I won't say how many years ago, but quite a few, at school, and the teacher was saying, trying to scare us with the commodification of everything and saying, you know, even one day water will be commodified and you will have to pay for water, something that falls out of the sky. And we were just kind of aghast. We kind of laughed, saying, that could never happen. That could never happen. It's such a common, freely accessible good. No right-minded society would ever make us pay for that. And so now that looks naive, but it shows you the cultural shift that's occurred, that everything now is part of the cash economy, part of the moneyified system of commodification, to the point where you cannot move without paying anything. I cannot step outside of my door here in East London without paying for something. To act is to spend, to live is to spend, and not because I'm particularly inclined to shopping, but it's just a basic necessity now that you have to kind of buy into.
So a kind of a transaction-based culture, that's how we're all living. It all becomes dreadfully empty.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's very, very transactional. It's very much based upon, the exchange of money. And And that was always the plan of this particular economic political ethos. That was always the plan, because if you go back to the Chicago School, they saw money as freedom. So they were thinking, you know, the little guy needs to be able to spend rather than be kind of provided for by the state. You know, he needs to be able to choose. She needs to be able to act this way or that way in the free market. So there was a lot of values based upon the idea of money. But as we've seen, you know, the exact opposite has occurred. Now I cannot go to university. Now I cannot do this. Now I cannot do that because everything's being moneyified. Now I'm being harassed by my bank. Now I'm kind of kept up at night because I can't pay that tax bill. So rather than it being the road to freedom, it's been the exact opposite in many, many cases. And so that story again isn't told, and I wanted to tell that story. In that context, no wonder we're working so much, right? Because what's our main source of income? It's our, I don't have any rich family to give me lots of money. I'm not prepared to become a criminal to get it unethically. And therefore, you know, I'm not going to kind of go through the unemployment industry, which is kind of deeply humiliating and designed to reduce my sense of humanity to a bare minimum. I'm not willing to do that. So therefore, I enter into the paid employment sector because I need to get my hands on these little symbols we call money that allow me to get stuff. No wonder employment and work is lionized to such a high extent in that kind of broader culture of money.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with economist, teacher and author, Dr. Peter Fleming, whose latest book, The Debt of Homo Economicus, has just been published by Pluto Press, where Peter argues, wreckage economics is a position of the elite that has become detached from democratic accountability, protected by flanks of amoral technocrats and thugs, systematically intent on sucking the life out of the public sphere while prattling on about jobs and growth. I asked Peter about the tragic case of Isabella Purves, an elderly Scottish pensioner who lay dead in her flat for 5 years before she was discovered. I put it to Peter how this awful case exemplifies everything that has gone wrong with today's society.
Yeah, sure. She was an elderly lady in a city in Scotland who basically found herself alone, you know. So loneliness is an epidemic at the moment because of all of our public institutions and our public ethos, the public sphere, if you like, has been eroded so substantially, and the individual, the lone individual, kind of glorified on the opposite side of the spectrum, and therefore lots of people find themselves living alone and spending them their time by themselves. And unfortunately, this retired woman passed away in her flat. Which is kind of sad in itself, but she wasn't found for some years until after, I think, 4 or 5 years, a pipe broke in her flat, and the plumbers had to kind of get in, and they found her mummified, basically, body. And it sparked a lot of debate at the time about what type of society would allow an elderly woman to go to pass away and for that to go unnoticed for so long. You know, what about her family networks? What about social care and so forth? I thought that was kind of a very tragic case in which it captured that way in which people in our society are being rendered into these kind of capsule-like individuals who really are on their own. They have no one to kind of call upon. The state is basically not there anymore as a safety net, and you've really kind of got just to make it on your own. And even though in all of the neoclassical literature, this is a great thing because it's individual empowerment, you know, it's you control your own destiny and all of that kind of stuff. The flip side is that we feel abandoned by society, and that there is a loneliness epidemic that is really kind of on the other side of that individualism. So it's not a critique of individuality. So I make a distinction in the book. I think being an individual is great. You know, I don't want to be like everyone else, and that and that individuality is something that we should cherish. Whereas individualism is kind of like a systemic, structural isolation that is ironically quite conformist in many ways, all being individuals in the same way, if you like. And I thought that this case kind of captured, you know, they talked to the neighbours and so forth, and it was really quite telling, you know, that one neighbour interviewed said, you know, things really changed in the neighbourhood when a major supermarket moved in. And I thought, that's really kind of strange, you know, what's a supermarket got to do with, and I won't mention the supermarket, but you probably have got a good idea of which one it was. And it was because everything became anonymized. So there was no longer the local butcher, or there's no longer the local baker that you saw on a daily basis. It was this kind of sterile, a very kind of cold, impersonal atmosphere in the town. And slowly, you know, the social bonds kind of disconnected. And when she did pass away, no one noticed for many years.
You know, you talk about, you know, the social bonds in the town disintegrating. But, you know, that's not a good enough reason. You know, whether you can put the blame at urban planners, large conglomerates coming in, big supermarkets, big chemists and so on. And, you know, how we're all so removed these days in our digital economy from the human touch. But that's still not good enough. You know, it's not a good enough reason, because we're all responsible for these types of cases. I was also quite shocked reading about Dawn Amos. She was 67. I think, and she was from East Essex, and she was taking part in the Fit for Work scheme, and she had problems with her local employment group on this. And you know, you talk about all the kind of the fears and anxieties people have when they're dealing with social services to hold on to whatever their sorts of credits are.
Yeah, no, that was a sad case, but also quite part of a trend that was happening here in England, where, you know, the Fit for Work kind of test basically was trying to shift people from sickness benefits and that type of care to into the workplace and to find jobs. And she did one of these tests and was deemed fit for work. And ironically, the day the letter arrived at her house, she had died of the ailment that was afflicting her. And her husband, you know, was just kind of saying, you know, what kind of society are we living in? You know, the government has basically was about to cut all of her social care funding, saying that she was healthy and ready to go to work, and there she was, unfortunately, had passed away because of the ailment she had. And I thought, you know, this is awful in the sense that, you know, a state, the government that is meant to be the representative of all of our interests can be so pitiless and so harsh and kind of mean in that respect. But also, goes to show how, again, going back to that point I mentioned earlier, how important, how be-all and end-all work has become, where, you know, even a sick woman who is kind of, you know, gravely ill is better to be seen kind of toiling in some sort of supermarket. The mind boggles to see what type of work she would have been considered fit for. But I had in mind some sort of supermarket or maybe cleaning or something like that. And, you know, it's better to see the sick person in employment rather than convalescing. And then the minister who is responsible for work and pensions actually come out around this time and said, you know, well, I firmly believe that having a job will cure you, that sick people should be working because work will cure you of your illnesses, and that it's better than medicine. I just thought this was really, really quite incredible. And kind of, even in this milieu, it wasn't surprising, and people didn't really kind of take that much notice or take it too seriously, because you expect to hear things like that from politicians. It just made me think that, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, you would never hear such a thing coming from a government official. It would be kind of pointed out as it would be named and shamed, you know. It showed me how much our culture had shifted in a particular direction that really kind of reduced everyone to their ability to work, and anything else was not important or even chastised.
You explore the very much the dark side of our economy, and you look at, you know, suicides in the shadow of debt, and especially with young students in with university fees and the pressures they're under. And you talk about survival borrowers. And then you highlight CEO remuneration, where CEOs are getting, I think it's 386 times more than the living wage. That's disgusting, yeah. Isn't it?
It's astounding. It's astounding. It's amazing that they've gotten away with it, and that's partially because it's all done behind closed doors. But with the shareholder revolts, you know, that are occurring in many of these organisations, we're getting to see what the actual pay and benefits are, and it's kind of just keys to the growing inequality, income and wealth inequality that has really spread like an epidemic across neoliberal societies, and has gained, weirdly enough, gained traction and speed since the financial crisis, rather than everyone would have thought it would have slowed down, but it seems to have gotten worse, which makes you wonder what exactly is going on, you know. But yes, it's totally unacceptable that someone should be making this amount of money in the face of what everyone else is being paid. So the relative inequality is really kind of almost sickening. That's to do with a whole set of reasons. Again, you know, just like the idealization of work, which was driven by a certain set of ideas that was invented by economists and academics, particularly in the United States. The same thing here, you know, the idea of, for example, in economics of principal agency theory basically says, you know, if you want your CEOs to kind of perform for your large corporations, then you've got to get them stock options and you've got to pay them huge amounts of money. And then there's competition between these CEOs because they're saying, well, I could go to another, you know. And so the ante is upped in terms of the pay, while the rest of us are kind of looking at this going, this is just really kind of unacceptable and really kind of incredible, given that we are living through a major recession, one of the worst kind of recessions, and that austerity is being given to us, and that the small elite at the top seem to have been enjoying this luxurious, almost socialist kind of existence.
I'm just wondering, what do you think David Graeber from the London School of Economics, what do you think he's offered in terms of our insights to how we're all evolving? Are the likes of Paul Mason, the British journalist and commentator, he's talked a lot about, you know, how we interact and engage with the digital economy and, you know, how vulnerable it leaves us all.
Yeah, no, I agree with most of what they say. David Graeber's work on debt in particular is an incredible study, and I would recommend anyone that hasn't read it to seek it out, because it really does give a interesting kind of historical analysis of where we've been and how we arrived here. Paul Mason's work on post-capitalism, I think, is really you know, it's a little bit optimistic in my view. But nevertheless, I think those voices that are kind of stepping out of the mainstream and trying to raise questions that aren't raised normally are really important. And I guess, you know, they're creating spaces in which I'm kind of trying to work as well, which I find really important. So the more people writing about this and this type of thing and raising these questions, the better, in my opinion.
But when we look at zero-hour contracts and the whole idea of the gig economy and, you know, how we're all playing into that, it becomes very frightening. Although some people are taking a stand, and as you say, some economists are looking at the broader implications, and there are some very politically adept people out there who are shining a light on all of this. You talked about the case of Steve Slater from JetBlue and, you know, his ideas on, you know, quitting and breaking the cycle of that exploitation and just finally saying, I've had enough. And just get lost, get stuff to it all. That, you know, we have autonomy, we have agency, and that, you know, some people could argue that that's easy for some people who don't have the same types of commitments. But surely if we don't take stands, it'll just get worse.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. Well, you know, individualization is the big driver here. Again, going back to that Chicago School of Economics idea that we should all be acting like micro enterprises or mini corporations, rather than being part of a working group who might collectivize and stand up to unjust conditions in the workplace. And so we've seen in the gig economy with Uber and Deliveroo, for example, people are actually collectivizing and protesting, which has surprised these corporations, because the individualization was so thorough that the chance and the opportunity to collectivize and to organize some sort of mobilized protest against these kind of conditions were thought to have been completely eradicated, but they hadn't. You know, people find ways to talk to each other, social media, various kind of informal kind of get-togethers. And so that really does show that there are opportunities, there are points within this overwhelming juggernaut, if you like, of fighting back and trying to get a better deal and to lessen the type of exploitation that has become kind of the new normal, if you like.
But it depends, Sarah, who you're fighting, because you present the case of Aaron Swartz. He was a 26-year-old American computer programmer or hacker, if you will, and he tapped into MIT's library, all on the idea of, you know, creating more open access and so on. But he paid a very tough price.
He certainly did. He certainly did. He was hounded by the government, the FBI, prosecuted gratuitously, many people argued, given the nature of his deeds, and to the point where he basically lost all hope and he committed suicide. And for many, including myself, I think that was the death of the internet as a progressive form of liberation, in which there would be a common, a cyber common, in which free, unpatented, uncorporatized information could be shared, and we could have a new kind of public, if you like. That really showed us, I think, that that wasn't going to be the case, that it's been completely taken over by large corporations, and that the dream of using the internet as a way of creating a new public domain really has been kind of snuffed out. And that death was particularly awful, simply because he was such a young man, a prodigy, very committed to social justice issues and free information, basically. He would say, you know, look at all of the knowledge that has been produced in modern society. Why should we have to pay for it? Because it's been produced by universities, it's been produced by state funding and so forth. But if I want to access a journal article, then I've got to pay enormous fees to actually get access to it. And so it was a really good cause, but he paid the ultimate price, which really kind of showed you the type of difficult set of circumstances that one would have to face in order to dislodge the logic of that privatization of knowledge.
How do you explain why so many people are either believe or are somewhat captivated by the idea of trickle-down economics? That, you know, if you know that we'll all benefit if the rich become even richer and that'll all kick back on us and so on. Do you think we're just deluded or just a bit too optimistic? How do you explain that?
Well, I think you've got to look at it over time. I think when those ideas were first introduced wholesale during the 1980s in the UK, the US, Australasia, various European countries, that the theory sounded new. The idea was that wealth, kind of, if you allow people to get wealthy, then that's going to make the pie bigger, if you like, and we all get a bigger share. It just didn't turn out that way, unfortunately, and that inequality was really the big outcome, if you like, of that ethos. And so I'm not too sure, and I have no data or evidence to back this up, but from my kind of sense of how things are going, I'm not too sure if anyone really does believe in it anymore. I think we've been disabused of the idea that allowing a plutocrat, an already rich plutocrat, just to get richer through shell companies and tax havens will make my life better and our lives better. I'm not too sure we really buy into that anymore. And that creates an interesting situation because the system is geared up to function as if we believe in it, but we don't. We're highly skeptical and cynical, hence all of the outrage around, for example, as something your listeners in Ireland will no doubt have heard quite a lot around tax evasion and various kind of protests around these large corporations who pay next to no tax, while the rest of us, of course, kind of dread that special day of the year where we have to get in our returns and pay the tax man.
Last question for you, Peter. What is your hope with this book? Are you hoping that maybe employers and employees will rethink, I suppose, the work environment and ideas around commando capitalism?
Well, that would be wonderful. When you write a book like this, there's a whole set of mixed objectives and hopes. One hopes that it will have an impact in some meaningful way that kind of improves the situation in terms of work and debt, given that it seems to be so bad at the moment. But in realistic terms, I just want my main hope, I think, rather than kind of, you know, I get asked all of the time, you know, so what's the alternative? You know, where's your blueprint? As if I've got this kind of large rolled up sheet that I can kind of let roll to the ground and, you know, well, this is where we put the hospitals and this is where we put this, you know, I'm not qualified to come up with a blueprint for a new society. But I would like to hope that a book like this starts a conversation, puts certain issues and questions back on the table that we might want to discuss rather than pretending that none of these things exist. So simply getting this set of problems that I think so many of us are facing onto the table for discussion so that we now can begin to put it into the public domain would be the main hope of this book. Thank you.
And that was economist, teacher and author Dr. Peter Fleming. The Debt of Homo Economicus is published by Pluto Press and retails for in around €17 in paperback. Now, I have to say, hats off to Peter. This is one hell of a book. It's compassionate, it's real and incredibly well merited. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Niamh McGee, who helped out with this evening's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the insightful words of American economist and author Milton Friedman, who once quipped, "History suggests that capitalism is a necessary condition for political freedom." Clearly, it's not a sufficient condition. How true. Good night.
Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.